right into my belt. And hopefully he'll come through with the Gemara.
Tomorrow?
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Get to this later. Hershus, Avi Mori, the... I guess this is working. The role of Moshe Rabbeinu in the process of the Miluim, in the Parshios that we've been reading the last number of weeks, Shmini, Tzav, is an intriguing one. Moshe Rabbeinu is involved, of course, in the Miluim, but only in an introductory and initiating capacity. 7 days of Binyan and Piruk, building and then dismantling, Avoda Bachaluk, the Avoda not in the Big Day Kahuna, but simply in a chaluk, and then finally, handing over the reins to his brother, to Aaron HaKohen. There are two views in Chazal, two perspectives on understanding Moshe Rabbeinu's role. According to one perspective, Moshe Rabbeinu was destined initially to be the Kohen Gadol. What happened was either Chet, different formulations as to what that Chet was, or the burdensome aspect of leadership of Klal Yisrael, his political leadership, interfered with that destiny, and it had to be handed over to Aaron HaKohen. From this perspective, that initial avoda that Moshe Rabbeinu was involved in was really the avoda. It's what should have been. It represents the ideal. But there's a second perspective in Chazal as well. That second perspective dictates that it was always the true destiny, not of Moshe, but of Aaron HaKohen, to be the Kohen Gadol. The fact that he wore a chaluk, not the Big Day Kahuna, was due to the fact that it was not really avoda after all, but some sort of prelude, introduction to avoda. The Piruk and the Binyan becomes clearer. The fact that it was necessary for Aaron to step up to accomplish the final Hashras HaShchina, as Rashi, quoting the Medrash, explains, is understandable as well. But according to this perspective, the role of Moshe Rabbeinu emerges as far more puzzling, challenging, and even perplexing. Why is it necessary that he be the one to initiate the Avoda if it's really not his domain at all? Moreover, given Moshe Rabbeinu's stature, wasn't his initial contribution perhaps problematic? However it to be understood, wasn't it likely to establish unattainable standards? Wasn't it likely to invite unflattering comparisons for the future? But perhaps the Torah, in telling us and establishing this role for Moshe Rabbeinu, conveys to us a powerful idea. The idea that the very association of Avoda with Moshe Rabbeinu set a tone of the reciprocal impact between the Oved and the Avoda, establishing the Avoda as a vehicle that itself promotes, but is also, at the same time, enhanced by greatness. As unique as Aaron HaKohen was, and indeed it was his destiny, especially according to this perspective in Chazal, he was no Moshe Rabbeinu. Lo kein avdi Moshe b'chol beisi ne'eman hu. That is the principle that is operative here. Moshe's uniqueness, after all, is one of the Yud Gimel Ikarim listed by the Rambam. While primarily this listing underscores another Ikar, the immutability of the Torah, which of course is Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah, still, the very fact of Moshe Rabbeinu's stature, that it is an Ikar, the singular role that he plays, all of this has the effect of projecting a role for him that implies the impact of greatness and great personalities in and of itself. There's a very famous debate, I've spoken about it in the past, between the Rambam and the Ravid, also regarding the parshas we've just been reading. They debate the scope of the halacha developed in Masechet Yoma based on these psukim that seems to demand a 7-day training period whenever a Kohen Gadol is newly appointed. The Rambam's perspective is that this 7-day period is necessary for any avoda that the Kohen Gadol will attempt to undertake. The Raibid disagrees and limits this requirement only to the avoda of the Kohen Gadol and Yom Kippurim. The Radvaz is a very famous question in Hilchos Kli HaMikdash in discussing this problem. Perek Dalet Halacha Yud Gimel. This is the Raibid's perspective, which is that the Kohen Gadol only has to wait out this period in the context of Avodas Yom Kippurim, seems to be contradicted by the Psukim themselves. After all, in the Miluim, wasn't it necessary for Moshe Rabbeinu to officiate so that Aaron HaKohen could have this 7-day training period, even though what was at stake was not Avodas Yom Kippurim? But I think in light of this idea, one could suggest that what the Torah meant to convey was not that Aaron HaKohen was inadequate to begin the Avoda without the training period, but that Moshe Rabbeinu was simply indispensable. The Avoda had to be touched by his personal greatness, because that would define the status of that Avoda, L'dorei Doros. Indeed, the first shiur that I ever heard in the yeshiva from Mori V'Rabbi, the Rav Zatzal, focused on a different aspect of this very same discussion of the Rambam and the Raavad. And again, on the difficult position of the Raavad. Why is it that only Avodas Yom Kippurim requires a 7-day waiting period for the initiate Kohen Gadol? What is so unique about that Avoda? In typical fashion, the Rav Zatzal explained that Avodas Yom Kippurim really is a unique Avoda. The Kohen Gadol functions not in his own right, but as a stand-in for Aaron HaKohen. The idea itself was based on a diuk reading in the Piyut of Atzer Kinanta, which describes the Kohen Gadol as Tachas Aaron HaKohen. In light of that, the emphasis of the psukim, Bezos Yavo Aaron HaKodesh, took on new meaning and new significance. The discussion in Chazal and the discussion in the Gra regarding the possibility that Aaron HaKohen's license to enter Lefnai v'Lefnim all year round might be different, but in some ways was the model for the paradigm of the Kohen Gadol, the Kol HaShana, integrated fully into the Rav's analysis. What the Rav didn't discuss was why it should be so. The very idea that Tachas Aaron HaKohen represents the proper category for Knisa Lefnai v'Lefnim on Yom Kippur is challenging. On the one hand, it reflects how greatness, the stature of a single and singular personality, can literally define an institution. Without invoking the legacy of Aaron HaKohen, perhaps there is no matir to enter Lefnai v'Lefnim into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. At the very same time, this identification also establishes, like Moshe Rabbeinu's initiation of the Avoda, almost an impossible standard, one that no other Kohen Gadol could ever hope to achieve. And that appears to be counterproductive. But apparently, the conclusion to be drawn is that the very association and identification to Aaron HaKohen, with all of the potential drawbacks of comparison, is sufficiently meaningful and sufficiently inspirational, both with respect to the level of the Avoda and the inculcated responsibility of that Avoda, that the transforming capacity of Tachas Aaron makes one, literally, worthy of the task. In the world of Torah, and generally in the world of Kedusha, exposure to and the experience of greatness is of central and enduring impact. Moshe Rabbeinu's initiation of the Avoda, Aaron's, HaKohen's imprint, Tachas Aaron, and then the Avodas Yom HaKippurim, these represent and reflect a much broader theme. We relate to our Chachmei HaMesorah with such great reverence. We perceive them as being so central to our worldview, not only for the direct legacy of Torah and of Yiras Shamayim that they leave us, but also because we do not just view them as experts, as technicians, even technicians of a complex Mesorah, but rather we perceive them, as the Gemara explains in several places, as walking Sifrei Torah. We view them as contributors to and not just transmitters of that special Mesorah. Although, in part, that contribution of being a contributor is itself something that stems from the initial self-perception and function as a faithful transmitter, as I'll later elaborate. Chachmei HaMesorah are far more than the sum of their knowledge. Their very personalities are formed in great measure by their commitment to and their passion for Torah and for Halacha. Of course, with the mix of their own experiences and predilections, which is that which differentiates them, but that itself, which is filtered through their commitment to Torah and to Halacha. The personalities of Chachmei HaMesorah become part of the Torah itself and part of that Mesorah. The loss of one of the Chachmei HaMesorah for that reason is always deemed to be an irretrievable one for Klal Yisrael. Kriya She'ena Mis'acha. The Hesped of a Talmud Chacham can take place even on days when other Hespedim cannot, because in addition to memorializing, eulogizing, remembering an indispensable person, the story of the life of a Talmud Chacham constitutes a kiyum in Talmud Torah itself. The combination of textual Talmud Torah and the Torah personality, critical to the very notion of a living, continuing Torah and a continuing Mesorah, Kol Ma Shetalmid Vasik Asa V'Chadesh Ne'emar L'Moshe MiSinai, is also, of course, the basis for authentic Das Torah, as we shall discuss. It's for this reason that Torah greatness is designed for this very flawed world. It resides in great but imperfect human beings, as the Rav Zatzal constantly emphasized. These indefinable elements of Torah personality and insight that results precisely from constant involvement in Torah values and conceptions, their own interaction, the struggle with personal imperfection, and the encounter of the challenges of the real world, these constitute the true basis for greatness in those rare Chachmei HaMesorah that grace every generation. We in this yeshiva experienced exposure to that quality of greatness for decades. The models of Aaron HaKohen and Moshe Rabbeinu are particularly apt for our own Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik Zatzal, who used to speak of himself as a melamed, noting that, notwithstanding all of the contributions and all the credentials of Moshe Rabbeinu, his singular contribution is defined simply, in one sense, as Eved Hashem, and in another, as melamed Torah Le'amo Yisrael. In his hesped for his uncle, Rav Elvel Zatzal, in Mavdo Deich Mido, the Rav noted, Lo Kein Avdi Moshe, that even among Gdolei Yisrael, there are some who stand out, who are simply unique, qualitatively different, even for the rest of that exalted group. Greatness is not identical with perfection. Indeed, one might argue that perfection precludes, doesn't allow for the expression of greatness. The Rav in particular projected this in his writings in his Shiurim. Yadus very much is a worldly, this worldly religion, which is designed to elevate flawed human beings in the imperfect world that they inhabit. True greatness is found in the struggle to redeem, a favorite word of the Rav, man's challenging existence by submitting to the transcendent and ideal values of Torah and Halacha, not in the attainment of perfection, but in growth and submission to Ritzon HaBorei. Our yeshiva and the broader Torah world experience this phenomenon, the exposure to the greatness of that kind of personality in the person of our Rebbe, and he largely shaped that world and certainly completely shaped our yeshiva. Like the models of Aaron HaKohen and Moshe Rabbeinu, the influence that he had was both direct and indirect, obvious and indelible, even invisible. Sometimes the invisible, albeit indelible, is the greatest impact of all, though often it is unconscious and almost always it's unarticulated. It's that invisible impact, the exposure itself, that provides for standards, inspiration, a critical anchor that allows for the navigation of halachic and hashkafic challenges in challenging times. The experience of the Rav Zatzal's presence, his imprint, constitute a singular incalculable blessing, and also imposes an awesome responsibility to try to further his legacy, a formidable task indeed, given the complexity of his alumnus and of his thought. On a personal level, I feel very grateful this evening for the opportunity to express public hakaras hatov. The Rav's Torah, his personality, simply his presence, profoundly has affected and shaped my own life, as it has so many others. Undoubtedly, this aspect was taken for granted, not always fully appreciated, like other precious gifts all of us experience that are more accurately valued after they've been lost. This assessment is not really a consequence of false nostalgia, but it really is a result of better perspective. Through the passage of time, this kind of serious, real influence is more evident to me, and I know to other Talmidim as well. In some respects, the influence continues to grow as we encounter and experience different things, as all of us continue to develop our own thoughts, our own ideas, and as they coalesce on various matters of halacha, hashkafa, and Jewish life in a challenging age. Chazal convey that great men, giants, continue to influence the world of Torah even after their passing. Sifsosehem dovavos bekever. Literally, they speak from the grave. And this, of course, is certainly true with respect to the content of the Torah taught and the continuing impact of that Torah on the Talmud and certainly on Talmidim of Talmidim who otherwise might not have heard it. The ripples, the reformulations that that Torah, the Chidushim, cause in the corpus of Torah. But for formidable, influential, rare Torah personalities, Sifsoseim Dovos Bekever also refers to a source of inspiration, strength, standards of integrity, ethical, religious, Ben Adam Mamakom, Ben Adam L'chaveiro. There's a feeling, often, of Dmus Dyukno Shel Abba or Shel Rabbo that really can be very powerful. One feels that he is being held to a standard of excellence, a standard of integrity, by one of the Chachmei HaMesorah. In some cases, the communication between Rebbe and Talmud actually continues even after the death of the Rebbe, as long as Talmidim allow it to. There's nothing mysterious and there's really nothing mystical about this. It is simply a function of feeling continuing loyalty and humility, trying to meet the expectations or the standards of a great man. The Rav frequently commented that he felt that he learned all of his Torah from his father, although, of course, much of his Torah was his own. Rabbi Eliezer, of course, famous for his statement, Me'olam lo'amar mashalolamad mipi rabo. He, too, credited all of his Torah to his Rebbe, although his Rebbe himself used to say that Rabbi Eliezer was a tremendous mechadesh. These statements fall into this category. On one level, this has a methodological basis. After all, the Rebbe doesn't just teach a content of Torah, he teaches a derech halimud, and if that derech halimud stays with the Talmud, then some measure of continuing influence is evidently felt. Moreover, one measures his learning, his conduct, and his policies, hopefully, based on the exacting standards of the Rebbe. I believe that all serious Talmidim of the Rav feel this continuing influence, this sifsosav dovavos bekever. They do so when they assess their own learning, their own conduct, and their own decisions. Because the Rav emphasized the halachocentricity of Yahadus and the importance of halachic values that flow from the halacha, his impact continues as well to be broad. This feeling of continued influence has nothing, of course, whatsoever, I want to make this clear, to do with the actual ability of any, even the most acutely sensitive Talmud, to really divine what the Rebbe would have said. But at the same time, nor is it connected necessarily to the Rebbe's perception of his Talmidim, or even the actual relationship that they had. This idea is solely rooted in the psyche and in the perspective of the Talmud. But frankly, it's no less influential and no less powerful for that limitation. In this sense, I don't think that my own feelings in any way are atypical, unusual, relative to other Talmidim of the Rav. Indeed, some of the Talmidim that you've already heard, some that you will hear, studied much longer with him and had much closer personal relationships with him. But like many others, most people developed in our yeshiva and in its wider circles, the influence was not only personal, it was also multiple, contributing to its pervasiveness and to its power. In my case, I can say that all of the formative and most important influences in my life, literally, are linked with this great Torah personality. I did not actually physically glimpse the Rav until, I think, the age of 14. But his impact, I felt, already from my infancy. My father, Shlita, who is here, was a close and devoted Talmud of the Rav since his days as a Talmud in our yeshiva. His Rabbanus, his communal leadership, his presidency of the Rabbinical Council of America, among them, always nourished from this close personal relationship. Growing up in our home, the Rav's authority and his stature in all things important were simply axiomatic. They provided us, even those who had not yet met him, with a religious foundation, with guidelines, with limits, with a sense of halachic confidence in our way of life and in our hashkafa, things that were crucial to our own self-image, to our drive to improve and develop, things that transcended any specific issue or any specific challenge. While flexibility and openness were valued, as the Rav himself valued them, it was also self-evident to us that halachic standards were the ultimate arbiter, that they constituted the central values, that principles had to be adhered to, even when inconvenient, even when politically incorrect. After high school, I was zochet to learn a year and a half in Yeshivat Har Etzion with Mori Virabi, Harav Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita, a transforming experience in which I was exposed further to the Rav's Torah, to his Hashkafa, to his profound influence on his Talmud and son-in-law. That, of course, in addition to Rav Lichtenstein's own compelling persona and his own Torah, which, of course, continues, I'm happy to say, to impact upon me. The 5.5 years that I spent after that in the Rav's shir were years that were critical for my own personal development and growth. Even though, by that time, the Rav was a more grandfatherly figure, struggling with certain physical challenges, which certainly affected the pace and the rigor of the shir. Yet, in terms of yedios, methodology, most importantly, especially looking back, simply the exposure, being in the presence of Godless HaTorah, the implications that that had for Talmud Torah, for Yirat Shamayim, for standards, for integrity, for religious ambition, the experience for me and for others was defining. I appreciated those years then, if somewhat with an admixture of frustration at having missed the most demanding and rigorous years, but I have to say, truthfully, that I appreciate those years and shiurim even more in retrospect, with the benefit of not simply nostalgia, but, as I said before, a better perspective. My experiences in the kolim in the yeshiva, under the tutelage of Rav Shachter Shlita, Rav Kahn Shlita, two prominent Talmidim of the Rav, are also part of this broader picture. The basis for profound Hakaras HaTov is self-evident, and as I say, my example is typical of countless others. Greatness, by definition, is indefinable and intangible. It's impossible to quantify, it's even difficult to try to assess. That which is great is, by definition, inherently more than the sum of its parts. In the Rav's case, the ability to define his legacy of greatness is complicated by a hallmark characteristic of his thought and his contribution to learning and to Jewish thought. The notion of complexity, the complexity of halacha, halachic thought, of Jewish and general life. A decade ago, when the Rav was Niftar, in the course of the Hespedim that followed, I noted, as I'm sure did others, the diversity of the presentations, in emphasis, even in the portrait that emerged of the Rav, and speculated about the likelihood that a pattern could probably be discerned linking the presentations and the presenters. I'm sure that, notwithstanding the passage of time, distance, and some perspective, in these rounds of shiurim and presentations, appreciations, the same probably basically holds true. I'm sure then, as now, that it applies to my own presentation, with all the effort at detached objectivity. It's important, however, to put this phenomenon in perspective, because I really think that it actually reflects and reveals much, not so much about the Talmidim, also about the Talmidim, but especially about the Rav's scope and his influence. Certainly it's not a function of self-aggrandizement, cynical or self-serving effort to project the Rebbe in one's own image. Nor does it reflect at all that the Rav came across as all things to all people. His integrity, his exacting standards, his principled posture, notwithstanding his gentlemanly manner, his generosity of spirit, and his flexibility, was unmistakable. Rather, the different emphases, and in some cases, different perceptions completely, stem from his enormous breadth and range. Imagine what it means to be the preeminent Rosh Hashiva, most prominent and profound Jewish thinker, most eloquent darshan and orator of the era. Moreover, the hallmark of his thought was its complexity, as I noted and will continue to note. As the Rav engaged a full range of topics, complicated ones, in an effort to chart religious halachic experience, to accurately classify halachic norms, categories that simply defy easy analysis. It's hardly then surprising that even devoted Talmidim accent different aspects of his areas of interest and contribution, or emphasize different motifs and themes, sometimes consistent with their own perspectives or predilections, personalities, strengths, or, in some cases, with what they actually perceive to be central or to be innovative in his Weltanschauung. Moreover, the inherent difficulty in attempting to articulate and assess that intangible of greatness dictates that people will draw upon their own strengths, the categories with which they're most familiar and comfortable, and the categories which are also most meaningful to them. This may not always do full justice to the subject, but it is understandable. And in some respects, it is a tribute, reflecting accurately the challenge as well as the stature of the subject, in this case, of the Gadol. The conviction of the Rav's Talmidim, of his shaping, molding impact upon them, quite a legacy in its own right, the classical self-image of a Talmid who perceives himself in his Rebbe's image, is at play here as well, as a second factor. This theme is a critical part of our Masorah, a crucial ingredient in the success and integrity of the Masorah tradition. It has been from the very beginning of Jewish history. Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram holied as Yitzchak. Yitzchak's self-image as ben Avram, building boros, managing his stay in a foreign country, Yaakov's initial self-perception as Ben Yitzchak, traveling to Beersheba, awaiting, expecting to be forbidden to leave Eretz Yisrael, his surprise in Beis El, all of these were powerful forces in the lives of the Avos, notwithstanding the significant differences in personality and ultimately in their destiny as it unfolded. That self-image of the Talmud, which does not preclude a critical stance that, of course, inheres an involvement in Milchamta Shel Torah et al. These are two different issues. Contributes especially initially to educational success, allowing Talmidim to imbibe from the Rabbeim, and so on. That self-image, which really is really an aspiration, remains an important foundation, even when the personal destiny and differences surface or unfold, as they in fact did with the Avos. Even after Yitzchak emerged in his own light, it was still Eila told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram only to see Yitzchak. The Rav's diverse impact is a function also of his own greatness, in a different sense, and in part a function of his educational philosophy. The Rav truly had a rare gift. His vast range, the compelling message, the Torah, the philosophy, the magisterial and commanding presence, all of this elevated his students, at least those who were open to his influence. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, 10 years ago, in his hesped, explained that the special electricity that one felt at the Rav's public lectures and shiurim resulted from the audience's unconscious realization, in some cases really an awareness, that he was truly enriching, spiritually enriching their lives, that they were experiencing the presence of greatness. This was, of course, particularly true, even more so, of course, regarding the more intense experience of Talmidim in the daily shiur, and particularly with respect to long-term Talmidim. The exposure, remarkably, often had the effect of accentuating, enhancing Talmidim's own natural talents, personal strengths, and personal predispositions, although, clearly, certain other dimensions of the exposure and experience invariably penetrated as well. Undoubtedly, different degrees with different Talmidim. The Rav was, in addition, educationally and philosophically encouraging of independent growth and of the development of personal strength and personal interests. He valued greatly individuality, creativity, invoking Lehi Damos Imitatio Dei as the halachic basis for creativity and self-development. The Rav did not seek to produce clones. He was a passionate advocate of the Milchamta Shel Torah and all that that Milchama implies. All of those, of course, within reason, within ranges that promoted growth in Torah and Yerushalayim, as we shall know. The Rav strongly promoted what I call the idea of Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, putting the Talmidim on their own feet, giving them the keys to their own independence. The range of his Talmidim, their talents, predispositions, interests, from this perspective, is really unsurprising. The healthy diversity is a critical part of the legacy, one that should be celebrated, one undoubtedly that will impact upon the future generation. But equally impressive, and often not as well accented, is the degree of commonality with respect to basic and core values in Talmud Torah and Hashkafa that really does bind his Talmidim together despite their diversity. Sometimes that commonality is not evident to others, and occasionally not even to the Talmidim themselves, and I'm sure that there are obvious exceptions as well. But I am certainly convinced that beneath the surface, in most cases above the surface, this constitutes another powerful reality of his legacy. It reflects itself in methodology, in categories of thought, in vocabulary, in cadences, sometimes in openness, sometimes in tenacious, principled stances, but it is certainly there. This too attests to profound influence and impact. The pivotal relationship between Rebbe and Talmud is really complicated, even dialectical, and it was certainly so for the Rav and his Talmidim. His goal of their independence could best be achieved by a measure of their initial surrender and dependence, so that they could fully appreciate and accept what he had to offer. Both of these motifs, of course, coexisted in the Torah and in the Milchamta Shel Torah, as they are not, cannot be mutually exclusive. Moreover, the Talmud, any Talmud of a great Rebbe, even after attaining his independence, continues not only to revere but to fully identify with and accept his Rebbe's authority, all things being equal, of course, tempered by his own sense of responsibility and conscience, values honed by his very experience as a Talmud with that Rebbe. This is the principle of L'Kvod HaTorah Nidoresh, articulated by the Ramban and the Ravid, and other famous Talmidim who in turn became famous Rabbeim. The Rav Zatzal, indeed, as others have noted, did not often say, Kablu Daiti, accept my positions. Temperamentally and educationally, I think, was foreign to him. Unless the alternative, and this is crucial, was outside the range of Elu Ve'elu Dibre Elokim Chayim, had transcendent consequences, or involved the overstepping of competence in a way that undermined the integrity of halacha and its processes. In those cases, and I'll elaborate this a little bit later, he was not reticent at all to impose his viewpoint. By and large, however, it was his nature and his shita to convince rather than to coerce. At the same time, this needs to be emphasized as well, with all their achieved independence, his devoted Talmidim thirsted for his halachic and hashkafic guidance. They were eager to follow his lead. They were unlikely to deviate from any of the important positions that he took and held. I'm not speaking of interpretations in the sugya, obviously, but of more core issues of halacha, halachic process, and hashkafa. Their devotion and their training, the nature of the relationship, and even more so, simply his stature and his commanding presence, made Kabul Daiti almost always superfluous. At a rabbinic convention some years ago, the Rav Psak on a certain matter was raised. One of the Rabbanim who was there rejected summarily the notion that this position be adopted as the normative conclusion. He argued, and I think sincerely, that the Rav's vaunted legacy of independence precluded his authority on this particular matter. It always puzzled me why he was so quick to invoke one teaching while cavalierly dismissing or rejecting the other. But more to the point, I think at this posture, as a knee-jerk reaction in any case, though undoubtedly sincere, reflects a basic flaw in understanding. The Rav generously, principally, sought to inculcate independence and within reason, even independence from himself. But his Talmidim revered his opinions, especially his halachic opinions, certainly his psakim, and his public halachic policy guidelines, such that it would have taken enormous personal confidence and conviction, or some other very powerful counterpressure, for them to consider a path that was different than his. They certainly do not follow his views mindlessly, nor would he want them to. But at the same time, they were all aware of his stature, his superiority. They were confident in his extraordinary intuition and judgment, and in his formidable stature. All very, very significant considerations, of course, in any search for truth. As noted, the Rav's contribution and legacy in Torah and leadership needs to be evaluated in light of the complexity of his own personality, views, and thought. His approach consistently was one that was balanced, nuanced, sophisticated, and, to use a term that is ubiquitous in his thought, dialectical. Briefly, I'd like to address some of these issues. Sometimes I think that they're misconstrued or not fully fleshed out, and to share some impressions and some observations. Each one is a topic in its own right, and I hope that I don't do injustice to a brief mention. Obviously, I intend to focus on matters that made a particularly strong impression on me, that are close to my own interests, but which I believe really are the Rav's influence, where his influence was decisive, in areas that are central to his thought and to his legacy. And of course, I add, the Ein L'dayan Elamasha Ein Avros. While the Rav's range was vast, his scope comprehensive, his anchor, his matrix, was completely unambiguous. Like Moshe Rabbeinu, I already mentioned this, his self-image was that of a Melamed. He was, I believe, in many respects, in the mold that he described Rav Chaim and his father, Rav Moshe Zatzal, Gedolim, who were both enormously complex personalities and sophisticated thinkers, and yet who possessed at the same time a certain simplicity, even naive emuna, as well as a childlike sense of wonder. His intellectual curiosity, enthusiastic inquisitiveness, the value that he placed on all knowledge and of wisdom, were integral parts of who he was. They contributed undoubtedly mightily to his sophistication, to his insight, and to his power of articulation. But should be understood also unequivocally that his total passion and devotion and his anchor was in Torah and Halacha. This was something that was completely unmistakable, in my opinion, to anyone with even the slightest personal exposure to him. Only those who never experienced him could be confused about his priorities or his program. His singular ability to depict, to articulate incisively the uniqueness of the world of Brisk in Ma Dodech Midod and in Isha Halacha require extraordinary sophistication, self-awareness, something that reflects all of these elements: the power of analysis and formulation, intuitive sensitivity, which is the special domain of a total initiate, and ironically, a measure of simplicity that is indispensable to describing religious devotion. The Rav was prolific, prodigious, enormously creative as a Talmid Chacham. The range and the quality of his Chiddushei Torah are simply astounding. The recently published Igros HaGrid, ranging over all of Shas, especially Taros, Zoraim, and Kachim, where, on the basis of his actual shiurim, his contribution hitherto had been less well-known, reinforces the picture. Recently, there's been very interesting discussion regarding his methodological contribution to the Brisker Derech. A recent article published by Rabbi Yochim Krumbein of Yeshivat HaRetzion, zeroing in, interestingly, on this question, specifically in connection to the proposition that what the Rav formulates on behalf of Brisk reflects, in some part at least, his own advances of the Brisker Derech. Although, typical of a Talmud in the image of his own Rabbeim, and in this case, Rabbeim ancestors, Rav Moshe, Rav Chaim, it's quite possible that he may not have been conscious of this. Certainly, he did not project it that way in his description. The Rav's creativity, though, has to be put into perspective in order to be more fully appreciated. To experience the Rav's shiurim, even his Torah in a secondhand way, is to confront, if one understands it, the convergence of intellectual mastery and achievement on the one hand with Yiras Shamayim on the other. The world of Brisk was initially criticized by the Torah world, in my opinion, of course, unfairly, for fostering independence, creativity, intellectualism at the expense of, or at least that could ultimately lead to arrogance and to the undermining of Yiras Shamayim. What's often misunderstood in that discussion is that the very assumption of the Brisker Derech precisely militates, when understood, against this abuse. When properly pursued, Torah's Brisk integrates Yiras Shamayim together with intellectual Talmud Torah in a truly profound way. One can't imagine a greater integration of Yiras Shamayim. In the Rav's articulation, Brisk perceives the world of Torah and the world of Halacha as an ideal divine world whose details and broader values as Dvar Hashem are intended to mold and shape Halachic man's personality, really to give his life meaning. Engaging the world of the Halacha is the highest form of Avodas Hashem because it precisely integrates man into that ideal realm. These Halachos, principles, values do not require any external validation from any other human thought system. They constitute an inner logic and possess an inner coherence. For this reason, undoubtedly, Brisk is attracted to, or at least has a special affinity to, the inner logic world of Taros, Kadshim, and to a lesser extent Zroim, in which there is no practical analog in the rest of the human world. Parenthetically, the Rav's challenge, since in the Shiurim and the Yeshiva focused really on Moed, Nashim, and Ezekim, and especially a lot in Moe, was to maintain Brisker purity in areas where other logics abound and still relate to the interface of those areas. He did so with distinctions like Kiyum and Masa, etc., a different topic. The separate and the highly abstract, formal, descriptive, reconstructive language of Brisk, Chalos, Kiyum, Gavra, Chefza, and so on, is connected to this theme, this idea of an inner logic, independent from any other vocabulary and any other thought system. The Talmud Chacham's role is to better understand the Halacha by analyzing the data, reconstructing the conclusions, accurately formulating them, but he does so by surrendering and submitting to the categories themselves. For that reason, Brisk is first and foremost not an explanatory, but a descriptive approach. This, of course, also parallels the Rav's famous distinction between what, descriptive normative conclusions, and why, rationalization issues in Machshava and Tamei Mitzvos. Again, a crucial element in the interface between the world of Halacha and Machshava, part of the hallmark of his thought. The surrender of mind and the surrender of heart, requiring literally, if one thinks about it, an act of faith, is a sine qua non for entering seriously into the world of creative Talmud Torah. The creative halachis that the Rav admires so much in Isha Halacha is one who becomes an insider in the system. But he does that by first fully surrendering and submitting to it, the ultimate act of Yiras Shamayim. It follows that halachic independence requires first years of initiation and surrender. Again, not coincidentally, these themes of the dialectical relationship between surrender and victory, independence, dependence, dominate the Rav's thinking on all topics relating to the religious experience. The Rav's actual shiurim in the yeshiva and elsewhere were really testimonials to this dialectic. His own creativity was a function of this transcendent Yerushalayim surrender, the contribution of an insider who had paid his dues in intellectual energy, emotional and religious faith. Reb Chaim's well-known opposition to the Musar movement discussed by the Rav Isha Halacha, those who study Torah are not ill, those who are not ill do not require spiritual medicine, said succinctly, entailed a reliance on the spiritual health and self-sufficiency that is promoted by the Talmud Torah experience. It seems to me clearly that that perspective is related to the perspective of what Brisk understands Talmud Torah is all about. Since true Talmud Torah entails submission and surrender, the immersion in Dvar Hashem, not only as a spectator but as a participant, why would there be need for any augmentation of one's spiritual program? Can one imagine a better recipe for religious growth, a more effective hedge against spiritual maladies than such a Talmud Torah? Of course, Talmud Torah's effectiveness in the area of tshuva, well documented, its ability to neutralize the Yetzer Hara, Moshcheil of Beis HaMedrash, all of this is well documented in Chazal itself. I think it takes on new meaning in light of this perspective. Reb Chaim may have been, perhaps, overly optimistic in his assessment of all Lomdei Torah, maybe even over-idealistic in projecting that even the committed, sufficiently perceive the implications or experience the process of Talmud Torah in these lofty terms as he probably did. But the stance that he projects remains inspirational, even if the pragmatic and the programmatic case for Musar has emerged over the years as a compelling one. Sure, Rabbi Blau is happy that I added that. In any case, the Rav Zatzal was literally nurtured on all of these conceptions, and he was a testament to them. His towering contributions in halacha and in machshava were part of the classical continuum of what he always referred to as the Chachmei HaMesorah that preceded him, about which he spoke so eloquently. His chidush was all the more impressive and significant and, of course, authentic because of its traditionalist roots and its traditionalist character. The ability to find new insights, new perspectives, to continue to mine, to develop further, to reshape the corpus of Torah from within, is the truly remarkable challenge and achievement. His reverence for Minog, Nusach HaTfilah, Piyut, I mentioned Ato Kananta before, Masechtot, Ktanos, even the Maaseh Rav of Gedolim of previous eras, alongside, of course, the obvious staples, Shas, Rambam, Rishonim, and Gedolei HaPoskim, the Rav turned these others into sources for Torah insight, expanding the corpus and therefore increasing insight in a meaningful way. I've mentioned this to my Talmidim often in the past. He spoke of his grandfather, Reb Chaim, both as a revolutionary who changed the face of Talmud Torah on the one hand, and at the very same time, with equal passion, as one who stood in a clear chain of Chachmei HaMesorah, including Rabbeinu Tam, the Ribi Gash, the Ravid, the Ramban, the Nesivos, and of course everybody else. It was self-evident to the Rav that both of these statements were true, that it would be absurd to think of Reb Chaim outside the framework of classical Talmidei Chachamim, and at the same time, that Reb Chaim's projection of abstract conceptions at the root of Torah and Halacha was a singular chiddush, one that, in the Rav's words, enhanced Talmud Torah and made it especially conducive to a more rationalistic world. It was also self-evident to the Rav that these twin truisms enhanced, they did not detract one from the other. The same mix of classicism and innovation, in some cases revolutionary innovation, can be said of the Rav's own monumental contributions in Halacha and in Machshava. The nature of his Chiddush in classical Talmud Torah is well known to the Talmidim of our Yeshiva, Baruch Hashem. It's reflected in the daily Shiurim of the Rosh Yeshiva, almost all of whom were Zoche to be devoted Talmidim, although it is unquestionably and rightly filtered through their own prism, the prism of these Talmidei Chachamim. His Machshava, unfortunately, is not as well known, partially because of its complexity and sophistication. That's part of its appeal that also makes it more inaccessible without serious effort. But the Rav's Machshava was indeed at once revolutionary and at the same time wholly traditional. Mori Virabi of Aaron Lichtenstein, Shlita, once commented on the sharp contrast between Rav Kook Zecher Tzadik Livracha and the Rav Zecher Tzadik Livracha in this respect. He noted the wide discrepancy between people's popular image, perception, and the substantive reality. While the Rav dressed in Western garb, he spoke and he wrote and he lectured, especially in his English language lectures and essays, in the cadences of Western civilization, articulated concepts with enormous erudition. It was reflected in his vocabulary, his nomenclature, his mastery of whole disciplines and range of concepts. Anybody who even looks at halachic mind, most of which is only about other matters, all leading up to the final 10 pages or 12 pages that reflect his purpose in writing it, realizes that this is so. The highly sophisticated, brilliant analysis of his Machshava, however, is really not different and radical at all. Indeed, the Rav's primary Chiddush in Machshava is the ultimate in classicism and traditionalism. It is nothing less or more than the reintegration of Hashkafa Machshava with normative Halacha. His efforts should be contrasted with those Jewish philosophies that look to other disciplines as a foundation. A criticism, of course, leveled against the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim and much of medieval Jewish philosophy, and even in more modern times of Rav Hirsch and others. And also with those who completely took the opposite tack. The Griz, his uncle, the Parashas Drachim, those who completely halachicized Agada and Machshava in a way that made them indistinguishable from the other, really, Agada and Machshava indistinguishable from Halacha. The Rav was able to mine the world of Halacha for broader concepts and outlooks that allowed for ideas to be rooted in the norms and yet to transcend them, to correspond to Halacha and yet to retain its own discipline. Of course, he viewed these perspectives as critical, often critical to a proper Halachic life. But this effort could only have been accomplished by one who was possessed of the mastery, insight, and depth to exact coherent values out of seemingly legalistic, gnomic norms. His achievements enhanced Halacha and Machshava both, integrated them, and yet did so without blurring the lines between them. The brilliance of this approach lies, as I said, in its simplicity and its self-evidence, though achieving it accurately and effectively requires the singular talents that the Rav possessed. In any case, his views are of course insightful, sophisticated, and inspiring, demanding religiously and intellectually, and in some cases transforming, but almost always totally traditional. My father related to me that about a year ago, when Family Redeemed came out, he met an individual who expressed some disappointment with the book, because it delineated, albeit with great depth, sophistication, even chiddush, a highly traditional perspective on issues of family. Anybody who knew the Rav's thought was not surprised by this at all. In any case, by this assessment, I do not mean to say that his insights were always known, that they're simply couched differently. Certainly they were not previously formulated in most cases. But the point is that having been articulated, they draw upon, and in many cases, really appear to best approximate the classical halachic perspective. In that case, they're traditional, and yet they're mechudash. This analysis, of course, is consistent with the traditional view, particularly apt to the world of Brisk, that true chiddush lies in the incisive ability to clarify or more accurately formulate coherently, thereby revealing or rediscovering, albeit maybe for the first time, that which is truly latent in the sources of the Mesorah themselves. Kol Masha Talmud Vasik Asa L'Chadesh Ne'emar L'Moshe Misina. The contrast to Rav Kook Zatzal, another towering figure, who may have looked like any European Rav, but aspect of whose machshava is indeed revolutionary, in some cases even radical, is clear. I'm not making a value statement about it. It's a topic in its own right, but I think it is a descriptive and factual statement. The Rav's halachocentrism, his focus on the world of halacha, his faith that the world of halacha yields that which is important to men in his life, is perhaps his major contribution to Jewish thought. It flowed precisely from his ambitious perspective about the world of halacha. Recently, there's been much discussion, and I believe misunderstanding, about the concept of Das Torah and the Rav's particular view on it. Again, the topic requires much greater elaboration, but I think it is important, understanding the Rav's perspective, to at least speak about it briefly. Critical to the discussion is the fact that the actual term and how others choose to use it or define it is really irrelevant to the real issue. Although undoubtedly, the term is partially responsible for much of the confusion. The claim of rabbinic infallibility is a straw man. As far as I know, it is one that has never seriously been entertained by serious Balei Halacha. The idea that Talmidei Chachamim have a kind of Ruach HaKodesh that gives them insight into issues that have nothing to do with the world of halacha, halachic values, or halachic policy is also quite an extreme view, one that falls outside the mainstream discussion of notions of Das Torah, except perhaps in some Hasidic circles. Most responsible Balei Halacha will advise that the doctor should be the one to determine if indeed one needs an operation, not the Rav. The Rav may be asked to give a bracha. That's a different matter. The idea that there's a notion, however, of siyata d'shmaya in the form of greater, though not infallible, insight or perhaps assistance, according to Talmidei Chachamim, perhaps resultant of his training and immersion in Torah and experience, and that Talmidei Chachamim therefore have a dominant role to play in various aspects of religious life, has much stronger views in Chazal. I won't go into the details at the moment. Though again, its parameters are unclear at best, possibly controversial. I'm not familiar personally with the Rav's view on this aspect of the problem. However, the notion that Talmidei Chachamim are not just textual halachic technicians, that their training and commitment attunes them and sensitizes them to halachic value issues, that they're likely to have superior halachic and hashkafic perspectives and intuitions that are in fact relevant to determining broader halachic policy issues, that I think is axiomatic to anybody who is familiar with the world of Torah, halacha, and its history. It's implicit in the notion of the walking Sefer Torah referred to earlier. In fact, that such individuals need to determine the thorny, crucial, transcendent and global halachic and hashkafic issues facing Jewish people of every generation is simply obvious. Moreover, in some cases, it is only these Chachmei HaMesorah who are equipped to determine that other tricky question, what is a neutral area and what is an issue of halachic policy and values, a critical element in the mix. It's obvious that halacha as a system transcends, though it is anchored in the details that are codified in Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam. Das Torah, whatever one wants to call it, may not always be equivalent to pure halacha, but it is certainly no less important because of the difference. In fact, the need for greater authority, sometimes simply greatness, the greatness spoken of earlier, is generally even more compelling in confronting the more amorphous and sometimes meta-halachic or havachic value or policy issues. The problem is not the validity of Das Torah as a concept, but the question of its scope, and of which gedolim are the ones equipped authentically and effectively to dispense it. Nowhere are these twin foundations for true Das Torah, or whatever one chooses to call it, the determination of broader halachic fallacy and halachic values, nowhere are these twin foundations articulated more forcefully and effectively than in the Rav's writings. His majestic depiction of the Isha Halacha, his stature, his status, I've already alluded to that. The personalities of Chachmei HaMesorah, their views, relevant to Torah, of course, integrate into the Mesorah itself, even if they are different, though not necessarily inferior, in their significance to textual halachos. At the same time, the Rav clearly eschewed a narrow notion of what halacha is and what its scope is, rejecting both extremes, those who see every problem as soluble, if only we could really find that existing sifkatan in the Shulchan Aruch that really does address it, as well as the opposite, worse view, that argues that if in fact there is no sifkatan in the Shulchan Aruch, or in some cases, if you just can't find it, then the issue is always neutral, or one of public policy, in some cases, politics. Isha Halacha and the Rav's other writings develop clearly the perspective that halacha is not only normative, but it is the central religious foundation of man and his purpose. The world of halacha is not only about specific laws and obligations in the Rav's worldview, but constitute a value system to determine interrelationships, to shape the Oved Hashem. Of course, much of this conception has its roots in the Ramban and his Perush al Torah. In halachic mind, the Rav argues that only from the sources of halacha can a true, authentic halachic worldview emerge. Implicit in his treatment and in his very life work is the idea that halacha, by means of the lumdus that conveys its values, has greater breadth, though of course it is rooted in the details of the Shulchan Aruch. The Rav believed that halacha and its values are the prism through which man is to evaluate all decisions, conduct, and so on. His views on public policy, public halachic policy issues, are well documented and flowed from this perspective. In fact, it was simply key and characteristic to his thought and to his life. The Rav determined halachic policy for our community in different ways, through his Talmidim, who were also Rabbanim, and more broadly and officially through the Rabbinical Council of America. He served as the head of his halachic commission. He was the halachic commission for decades. His encouragement of secular studies, his complex stance on Christian-Jewish dialogue, on relations between Orthodox and other Jewish communities, including his Klape Pnim, Klape Chutz guidelines, we can speak about extraneous matters, matters of political and social and economic and general spiritual cooperation. We cannot talk about matters of theology, cannot negotiate or even discuss matters pertaining to real frumkeit, matters of halacha. These were the guidelines that he set for Rabbinical Council of America involvement in the Synagogue Council of America, an organization that represented all Jewish branches. His psak about passing up the critical tkiyas shofar if it meant going into a conservative shul to hear it, and many other issues, exemplified this approach. His guidelines were strong and they were principled, and they were also unambiguous. They were absolutely not only advisory in nature, they were clearly meant to be implemented. They were articulated passionately and forcefully. Characteristically, these policies were short on textual proof. They were long on their absolute conviction, rooted in halachic intuition, and they were certainly no less authoritative for that reality. This, of course, in the finest tradition of Chachmei HaMesorah L'dorei Doros. His positions were compelling. They were powerful in their suasiveness. At work, clearly, to anybody who wanted to see it, was the halachic and hashkafic intuition of a true gadol confronting responsibly critical yet amorphous challenges. The Rav's famous 14th animamin, his unshakable conviction that halachic life could be effectively implemented in any historical condition, no matter what the challenge, undoubtedly relied on responsible yet decisive role of attuned Chachmei HaMesorah, tackling not only hardcore halachos, new issues that come up, but also and especially as they determined broader halachic policies. Of course, the Rav also had a healthy sense of the appropriate limitations of halachic intuition or halachic value input. He concluded that some issues, perceived by other gedolim as halachic or hashkafic, were in fact neutral. I believe that his stance relating to the returning of parts of Eretz Yisrael has particularly been misunderstood. His approach, consult the generals to determine what is best for security, is often invoked by people who I think misunderstood to demonstrate that public policy is neutral, that it is determined by experts, not by rabbis. In fact, it's not the case at all. The Rav first established, to his own satisfaction, that Pikuach Nefesh might justify the return of land of Eretz Yisrael, as painful and as problematic as that otherwise might be. Having come to this legitimate halachic conclusion, he then indicated that the matter, in fact, next step, turned on the security expertise of the generals. He may have been more sparing and more rigorous in invoking Das Torah or its equivalent compared to other contemporary Gedolim. There were also issues that he felt were issues of Das Torah that other Gedolim felt were not. But whatever we call it, his Das Torah was a crucial ingredient in his Hashkafa, communal leadership, and critical to his legacy. His careful but determined and extensive exercise of halachic intuition in issues, private and public, that were brought to him is undeniable. The Rav's perspective on the total centrality of halacha and its breadth made it intolerable for him to abide anything that would undermine the integrity of the halachic process or the halachic system. The only time that he ever expressed public pique, in some cases it was stronger than that, at least in my days, and from what I've heard generally from reliable sources, was when he witnessed a corruption or a misrepresentation of halachic methodology. His uncompromising hardline stance on the ideology of the conservative and other deviationist movements, his rare condemnation of irresponsible, unorthodox positions sometimes projected, unfortunately, by orthodox leaders, exemplified this. He spoke passionately in opposition to those who would historicize Chazal, question its chazakos, or even simply trifle irreverently with Chachmei HaMesorah, Makhish Magideha, as he quoted the Rambam. His politically incorrect, courageous stands literally saved orthodoxy in America, and certainly our community. By all evidence and by all accounts, the Rav was extremely tolerant of and even empathetic with respect to people's frailties, their flaws, even ones that led them to transgressions. But he certainly could become incensed and was totally impatient with people whose character flaws included unethical behavior, intellectual dishonesty, and particularly those who were responsible for making a mockery of the precious Mesorah of the halachic system, intentionally or, in some cases, by overstepping their own competence and their own authority. It is true, the Rav welcomed involvement and interest in the halachic process. He encouraged Rabbanim to investigate their own shailas as a matter of halachic responsibility and personal involvement. He did not feel that it was proper for Rabbanim to pass every shaila to greater authorities without at least engaging the issue at hand. In some cases, he also encouraged Rabbanim to paskin their own shailas on the basis of their own research and their own conviction when he felt that they were competent. At the same time, he also responded to shailas. He also had no patience for psak or halachic policy that was shallow, that overreached the competence of the meshiv, and he particularly felt strongly that the more global, consequential, and complex issues be handled only by those few rabbanim in the rabbinic hierarchy that were equipped to do so. He himself served that function for his talmidim and for the RCA. The rare deviation from his norm of generosity of spirit, gentlemanly nature, his ferocity when faced with this kind of compromising, undermining, reflected his principled, ferocious passion for Torah as a system that gave meaning to life itself. It also stemmed from his high standards and his intense ambition for the community that he served and that looked to him for leadership. Undoubtedly, his exceptional openness was enabled, even as a lechatchila, precisely because of the clear and principled limits that he set and that he ferociously fought to maintain. One of the Rav's most passionate battles was the battle against the notion of religious subjectivism. This topic constitutes an important leitmotif in his writings, in his discourses, even when other issues were being addressed more directly. His view of the uniqueness of halachic life, again, is what mandated this position. Halacha represents Hashem's directed framework for Avodas Hashem. Its objective divine structure alone fosters the potential for meaningful contact with the omniscient, omnipotent creator. The Rav argued, halachic frameworks themselves require matirin, religiously validated actions that open the door to what otherwise would be deemed inappropriate, presumptuous attempts by unworthy man to encounter his creator. Thus, he understood that tefillah, that brachos, serve this function. From the Rav's perspective, the effort to bypass the halachic system or to change aspects of it without authority in order to accommodate subjective spiritual needs is completely antithetical to Avodas Hashem. In some contexts, he even argued that religious subjectivism, even when sincerely pursued, constitutes self-worship bordering on Avodah Zarah. Only within the halachic system, on the basis of its internal value and the value that it assigns to one's conduct, can one engage truly in Avodas Hashem. Thus, he disapproved of new ritual, of simulations, of other unauthorized significant changes to halachic norms. His drashas on Korach, on Nadav v'Avihu, focused directly on this theme. The hour is late, otherwise I would suggest an expansion of that, particularly with respect to Nadav v'Avihu, Nadav v'Avihu's sincere religious subjectivism, and of course, side by side, the insincere, exploitive religious subjectivism of Korach's, as the Rav billed it, common sense rebellion against Judaism. At root of the entire perspective is a notion developed in a famous footnote in Isha Halacha and pervasive in the Rav's thought that religion, spiritual quest, and halacha are not about man's comfort and peace, but constitute a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam, a struggle characterized by victory and defeat, surrender, submission, occasionally triumphs and victory. The halachic framework organizes this odyssey. Within it, there is room for legitimate individual expression, allowing those who are really committed to it, dedicated to it, to achieve spiritual excellence and really a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. In his Hesped for Avelbel Zatzal, the Rav developed the distinction between Erisin and Nisuin. Erisin, the Kinyan, formal, legalistic, Nisuin, the intimate, Ishus. He developed the idea that Avelbel and his relationship to Torah and to the Ribbono Shel Olam was so direct, so intimate, that it was in the mold of Nisuin. I've always thought that one could apply the same paradigm to the Rav's life with a twist. I would add that in his analysis of halachic life, his distinction between experiential kiyumim, in some cases the objective of the enterprise, and legal masim, the methodology of getting there, the Rav articulated more effectively than anyone else the critical indispensability of Erisin as the formal legal structure that ultimately enhances the goal of Nisuin. In a sense, the Rav was the Ish Ha'erisin V'HaNisuin. His passion and ambition for Talmud Torah really was legendary. Marathon Shiurim reflected this. His impatience with almost all of the Talmidim in the room, who didn't fully share the same commitment that he felt, was really self-evident in his annoyance. He would express his frustration, even incredulity, with those of us, almost all of us, myself certainly included, who began to fidget when the shiur got stuck on some point and went on and on. The gap between the Rav and his Talmidim at those moments was clear. He simply could not understand how we could let the problem go without a satisfactory solution. The response, the gap, spoke volumes about what Talmud Torah is really about. his frustration was a more powerful Musa Shmuz than any other that I've ever seen. And that doesn't mean, again, that they're not very important. When the Rav conveyed in a public shiur to the rabbinic alumni, the Talmud Torah preserved his sanity in the year of his triple Avelus, Lulei Tarascha Shashuai Oz Vanti Beretzanyi, it sent shivers down everybody's spine. Clearly, it was not posturing, simply a great and simple Gadol bearing his soul. His personalization of the Chachmi HaMesora and the Mechamta Shel Torah, the story in the end of Ubikashti Misham, and many others, were powerful things to witness and to hear and to read. His physical transformation, also well known, in the course of his shiurim, gathering strength as it went along, his own sense of halachic reality, his relentlessness in pursuing the Pshat and the Rambam, tenacity in that last Yortzeit Rasha, in overcoming the physical challenges and obstacles that had been posed to him, and yet to continue that shiur, all those experiences had lasting, indelible impact on his Talmidim and the whole audience. They too are part of the experience of greatness, that which impacts on those who can't, those who are not able to analyze, to articulate its significance. Let me conclude just by noting the Gemara in Tmura, similar Gemaras elsewhere. Gemara in Tmura, Daf Tzayin, tells us that Bimei Evlo Shel Moshe, 3,000 halachos were lost. And then the scramble ensued. I'm sorry, it's too late. I'm well over my time, so I'm not going to read it. To try to recover those halachos, Yoshua and Shmuel, Lava Shemayim Hi, in a Torah, in Navi Rashoi, Lechadish Davar Miata. The Gemara also relates that before he died, Moshe Rabbeinu came to Yoshua poignantly and asked him, is there anything you need to ask me? Yoshua responded and he said, Don't you remember, Moshe Rabbeinu? I've spent all of my life in your presence. I know it all. I've been exposed to it all. The Gemara then records the Chalishas Das and their two Girsos, either Moshe Rabbeinu, who heard that he was no longer indispensable, or, as the Girsa that we have it, of Yehoshua himself. And we're told that Yehoshua lost some of his Talmud Torah. The Gemara in Brachos speaks about a case of Talmidim walking along. All of a sudden, they had a Shaila about Zimun, and they felt paralyzed because their Rebbe had died. They didn't know who to turn to until one of them was able to reconstruct the proper conclusion. When a Talmud Chacham dies, his Beis Medrash is to be batel. It's paradoxical. Shouldn't we be learning his Torah immediately, preserving his legacy, sesosov dovos bekever? But all of these Gemaras and many more attest to one simple fact. When the Gadol leaves, it's first necessary to pause, to absorb the enormity of the loss, to become aware that as much as you've heard from him, like Yehoshua, you haven't heard it all. Not only because he might have continued to be Mechadesh, but because the personality and simply the presence itself, beyond the Torah, even if one could glean it all methodologically, is a Torah in its own right. For that reason, Moshe, but maybe better, Yehoshua, had Chalisha Sadas. He lost some of his knowledge because he lost a certain perspective. Bimei Evel Shel Moshe, 3,000 halachos were lost. The Talmidim were paralyzed. They didn't know what to do about Zimun. And Beis Midrasho needs to be batel in order to accent this indefinable, amorphous element. But of course, once that pause has been made and acknowledged, then the Sisosa Dovavos Bekever can continue. At that point, the presence of the Rebbe reemerges, albeit with the sense of loss. The Mesorah continues, and Asniel ben Knaz can be Machzir as Adavar Mitoch Pilpulo, the Pilpulo, undoubtedly, that had its roots in Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu. The Talmidim were able to figure out what the Psak is, possibly what the Rebbe likely would have said. And Yehoshua was able to continue as the leader of Klal Yisrael. The methodological foundation and even that sense of greatness continues. In this way, the grand chain of the Mesorah continues as well. L'hagdil Torah u'l'hadira. Thank you.